This is a CBC podcast.
Hey, I'm Craig Norris, and I want to invite you to check out the R330. It's kind of like Quirks and Quarks, except I don't talk about space or science or anything like that. Instead, I play the week's best Canadian indie music. Head over to cbcradio3.com for all of the info.
Hello, I'm Michael Enright. This is the Rewind Podcast. Rewind mines the gold from the CBC Radio Archives. Today, an hour from September 1970, the program was called Something to Say, and it featured interviews with artists, singers, and performers from stage and screen. In this episode, you'll hear interviews with three of the hottest musicians of the day: Jim Morrison of The Doors, Grace Slick of Jefferson Airplane, and Charlie Allen of the group Pacific Gas and Electric. Pacific Gas and Electric was one of the first interracial bands in Los Angeles, and is probably best remembered today for its hit, Are You Ready? Charlie Allen started out as the drummer, but his singing was so electrifying that he soon became lead singer. From September 1970, here is Warren Davis.
Rock and roll isn't just a fad. It's the music of a generation who've grown up in the atomic age, the age of space, jet travel, a rising tide of noise, instant communication, material abundance, and rapidly changing concepts in human morals and beliefs. For young people, rock and roll seems to be a unifying force, not simply a means of enjoyment, but a way of expressing what they think and feel about life and what's going on. Today's young songwriters and performers definitely have something to say. In Los Angeles and San Francisco, Tony Thomas went after the philosophy of rock, first with Charlie Allen, the young black lead singer and composer with a group called Pacific Gas and Electric.
Charlie, pop music today among the young people seems to be a very communicative form of art, doesn't it?
Well, yeah. If you see a kid, you know, walking down the beach with a radio and he's got his radio turned on to a particular station, a particular rock station, then you can right away relate with him. And, you know, you can just about tell where he's at, where he comes from, and the whole thing, just about what station he's listening to and what song he particularly, you know, is shaking his head to. You know, that's just, sure, it's very communicative. There's a whole vast sort of culture that goes into that whole thing. And I see it from one point of view that might be unique in that we create part of the music, you see, part of the music that brings these people together. And that's all, these people are just getting together, and the pop people, the musicians, rock and roll musicians, are the oracles. They all gather together. There's thousands of them. Like Woodstock was a good example. Just recently, I understand there was just thousands of people at a pop festival in Atlanta, Georgia. You know, and they all just came there and sat in the sun, and it was hot, you know, and it, I guess it was dusty and everything, but the music was a thing. And these people that are doing this music are really saying a lot.
This rock music seems to be a kind of religion today, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's evolved, I guess it's evolved to that state where I've heard many people say that all I want is my music. I can do anything with my music. I can study to my music. I can, you know, just anything. So it takes a huge place, a large part of life.
These gatherings have been phenomenal, incredible things, where you can gather hundreds of thousands of young people to the sound of this music like a Pied Piper.
Yeah, and they come to exchange ideas. They come from all over the country. They want to talk. They want to make love. They want to see one another. Cultural exchange.
Well, that's a new level of human experience, because the old ballroom dancing, you just want to dance. But now you say young people gather to the sound of this music and they exchange ideas.
But don't you think, don't you think that in the old ballroom dancing also that the people came to listen to the music? I seem to remember somebody telling me about Frank Sinatra and the Bobby Soxers and the whole thing. Now, I don't know what he was saying, the moon in June, which is a whole different thing nowadays, but people went to meet one another. It was a social event.
From the outside, it looks as if there's a uniformity. They seem to look alike and dress alike and talk alike. Now, what does it seem like from the inside?
It's pretty much the way it is, the way you stated it, except from their point of view or from our point of view, possibly, you know, the average businessman, you know, we tend to think that these people look alike, talk alike, but, like, don't have as much to say, really.
Yeah, well, you were mentioning a moment ago that things are being said in these lyrics that people want to hear.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think is being said?
Basically, I think it's a cry for... I think people would like to slow down. some of these kids are, say, from 14 years down, you know, they haven't had much of a chance to do anything with this world at all. And it's being taken away from them. We're now to the point where we can just blow it all up with one little button, you know, one little detonator. You know, never before in the history of man has that ever happened, you know, where you could just destroy the whole, literally destroy the world. We've got this thing with, you know, air pollution, and the Earth is a marvelous place. It's all we got. And I'd like to see people slow down and take stock of themselves. I mean, we're up to our necks in garbage. I don't like that. You know, that bothers me. It's my world, you know, as well as it is everybody else's. I'm not going to, you know, go and litter, you know, throw garbage on the beach or have the air so you can't breathe it. You know, I'd like to, that's personally my opinion. I just like, you know, I want things to kind of slow down. I would like people to take stock of themselves rather than to rush off into one thing, you know, from one syndrome to the other without even thinking. People have a tendency to walk around, you know, like sheep. I think people are a little bit frightened by what they really don't understand. And it's not that hard, really. It's really not that hard to understand. All you have to do is open up your mind and look at things a little bit.
Well, we hear terms like dropout today, yeah, and non-involvement and anti-establishment. It has sort of a negative turn to it. I think that scares people.
Yeah, well, I guess so. I can see that, too. I can see where if a man spent 40 years of his life building up his business or building up his way of life, his community, and somebody said anti-establishment, right away would think they're going to tear down, you know, my business and my home. It doesn't mean that at all. It means that the establishment or the society as it's set up isn't working. It's not quite making it. And to be against it doesn't mean negatively. To be against it, it means like, okay, I'm against it, so I'm going to offer you something better. I think I have a better way. And I don't know. It's got to be done. We've got to get it together, because otherwise there's not going to be anything left for anybody. Imagine if you were 18 years old, and you know, 18 years is compared to, like, you know, 75. You could live to be 75 or 80 years old, and you're young and you're vibrant. You feel, you know, good, and you got a spring in your step. And you why do you want to? You don't want to worry about, like, breathing the air. That's yours to breathe anyway. You know, but you have to worry about things like that when you're 18 years old nowadays.
Do young people respect life and nature and love as much as they should?
I think so. These people are really seekers of the truth. The truth is the one absolute. And it really doesn't matter, just as long as they respect anybody that says it like it is. I respect anybody that says it like it is. The truth comes in many, many, many hues.
Charlie Allen of Pacific Gas and Electric.
I'm Michael Enright, and you're listening to Rewind here on CBC Radio 1. What you're listening to is an hour from September 1970 in the program Something to Say. The next interview is with Grace Slick of the group Jefferson Airplane, who was one of the first female rock stars. She was known for her powerful voice and her psychedelic lyrics. Here once again is Warren Davis.
Now to San Francisco and the Jefferson Airplane. And for the uninitiated, this has nothing to do with aviation. In fact, names of many rock groups seem to have nothing to do with anything, a sort of comedy of the absurd. The Jefferson Airplane has one girl singer, Grace Slick, who also writes many of its songs. From a middle-class background and a graduate of Finch College, Grace was recently invited by fellow classmate Tricia Nixon to a White House afternoon tea party. It was an invitation sent to all the girls in the class. When Grace turned up at the White House, she was recognized and denied entry as a security risk, which says something about the dichotomy in American life. Grace Slick freely admits that the Jefferson Airplane is a kind of functioning anarchy, and that they and all the others must make commentary.
Grace, one of the things that bothers people about rock and roll is that it's hard to hear the words to understand the lyrics. This puzzles me. I mean, what's the main point of this kind of music?
It's more or less of a feeling, and has more to do with music than lyrics. The kids know the lyrics, or they don't. They can either care about it or they don't care. It doesn't make any difference one way or the other, because you get it one way, it's a feeling. The other way is sort of intellectual and trying to figure out what the person's saying. But they get lyric sheets in the record album, And then they know what they are, and it's easy to figure out once you can see it and match it up, you know, with what you hear. So they pretty much know them because they're already written out, and they do want to know what you have to say, and they kids don't worry about it too much.
So why is this kind of music so loud? Is there a real reason for that?
Yeah, there's a genetic reason. In Scientific American, they had an article that said the female fruit fly will not respond to the male fruit fly unless she hears from him a song that is 115 decibels in volume. Now, that may also and probably does have something to do with the young female and male of the human species. A loudness. Why are marching drums loud? They call people to get people moving in one way or another. Loudness always. People are not too subtle yet. Their brain. I don't think our brains have developed to where we're capable of discerning subtleties. It still takes a punch in the face or something to get somebody to do something. Obviously, this country's still murdering people to try to get them to do something. I'm not saying it's right. It's just that we're too stupid yet to figure it out any other way. But, and it also may be something we cannot correct, like the fruit fly thing. It's totally genetic. She has to, that volume, those particular amount of decibels get her off, so to speak. And that's one reason. It's physical. And another reason is that with electric instruments, a certain volume is actually needed in order to produce certain tones. If you want a whining, sort of searing tone that has a flutter in it or something, and there are definite tones you can get out of an electric guitar, it has to be up to a certain volume. Otherwise, it doesn't feed back, and the guitar player can't handle it. I mean, you can't get that tone out of it. So you have to be at a certain volume sometimes to get certain tones.
Is there any correlation between the loudness of this kind of music and the defiance of young people today?
Yeah, probably. It's an awfully effective way of shutting people off. Cops will, from time to time, come and tell us that, listen, the show's running late, and there's a city ordinance saying that all 14-year-old girls have to be home in bed after a certain period of time. And no, but, you know, as a rule, usually the law is made up in 1885 or something, and it's just this old thing that's been left over. So if they're speaking over the microphones, the guys can just start playing. And once they start playing, nobody can hear anything, so a cop can't say anything. The microphone that you're holding in front of me, I'm used to using a microphone. You're used to using a microphone, so it isn't quite the same. If you hand a policeman a microphone, they get uptight if they have to come on stage, and you wait until they get nervous enough so that they do come on stage, and then just say, here, you tell them. You tell the kids to go home. And that makes them nervous, and sometimes they won't even talk. You know, they say, no, you tell them, you're the performer. I say, hey, listen, I don't want to stop. You're the one who wants to stop it. Speak, you know. This is it. It's your stage. And then everybody goes, da-da-da-da-da-da, ah, you know, and the guy, sometimes they'll talk, but they're real embarrassed, and you can see that the neck's all red and the veins are standing out and everything. So it is, in a way, a defiant thing. But if somebody tells you something that you know is ridiculous, chances are you're going to react that way. It's like somebody coming up and saying, don't wear the color red. It is morally wrong. What do you mean it's morally wrong? You just know in front that that's ridiculous. So you're going to probably react with an equally as ridiculous answer. Because in the face of such stupidity, how else can you react? Except punching, and that's dumb. So these games, I think, are better than killing, unless chemically and physically we can get out. Physically meaning off the planet, because if you look around, I think probably anybody will notice that nobody is actually doing anything about ecology. They're talking about it. The only thing we can do is get off the planet, get the good portion of the population onto other planets or onto space stations. And unfortunately, our government's cutting down on space spending, which is a little silly because that's the only place we have left to go. And that is the physical thing. And then the other thing is maybe through chemistry, we'll be able to build better minds and bodies. And that sounds like a pun, you know, better living through chemistry and LSD and all that other stuff, but it could be. It worked out. I mean, nobody said to Louis Pasteur, hey, that's morally wrong what you're doing. He's figuring out something, a chemical, that is going to reverse the bad action of some other chemical, which is another bacteria disease. It's the same thing with acid. Now, it hasn't been worked out, and it's young. It's like a new Ford. Chances are it's going to fall apart, and it's going to smoke and steam, and you got to get out and crank it up. And same thing with the mines now. There are a lot of people, you know, misusing it, and people are falling apart. Anything new is not going to run right. Okay, well, now, the thing is, everybody wants to stop acid. The point is not to stop it, but to start looking at it, experimenting with it constantly, using it, you know, trying to figure out where it does go, how to use it wisely, chemicals, how to get the mind so that it no longer does want to kill when it can't figure out any more words to say. People, it seems to me, people kill because they're stupid. Because they can't figure out another way around the problem. And if we can fix that up with chemicals, why not? People say, hey, that's a fast way to nirvana. Oh, I'm not trying to reach nirvana. All anybody's trying to do is just help it out a little while. Worry about nirvana later. You know, that's some other thing way off over here. I'm talking about chemicals practically. Just trying to keep the planet kind of moderately level. So Kids are getting smarter, I think, because there's better chemistry and food and things are being grown better and medicines, so forth. But also, they know a lot about everybody in the world. There isn't as much of a prejudice against other kinds of people because they see them all the time. They see them on television, if not, in fact, in the flesh, and they realize they're human beings just like everybody else, and even very interesting human beings. Look at that guy, far out. He's got that color skin, he wears those kind of clothes, and he talks that way. That's very interesting, you know, great. And he looks at you and says, different, you know, got blonde hair, da-da-da, whatever it is.
So you generally take a hopeful view of the young generation, an optimistic view.
Yeah, I think if they can get off the planet, I don't take a very optimistic view if we have to stay on the planet, because I don't think it's... I mean, we've just ruined the planet.
Grace, you obviously do your own thing, and it works very well for you, but I wonder, can you describe what it is, what you are? What is your lifestyle?
The main idea is to be as pleasant as you can. I don't feel turn the other cheek is my way of living. As I said before, if somebody hit me and I could, or it made sense at the time to hit them back, like if they weighed 250 pounds, I would probably not hit them back physically. I would probably retaliate one way or another, though. I mean, I just don't see any point, because I don't see any point in somebody going around hitting me. I would not hit anybody first. I have no eyes to hit them first. And I find it stupid. I think it's a sad way to stop an argument. I can remember talking to my parents, and they'd say, stop arguing. Why? We haven't finished yet. We haven't come around to the end yet. They may have been right. Maybe I was being feisty or something. But when somebody stops an argument, it's always disturbing, because you haven't concluded it until somebody recognizes a point one way or the other of the other side. And if you got any brains at all, you're going to have to recognize something sooner or later. It may take you a year. You know, come on back tomorrow for another hour. You know, we'll work it out. But this business of stopping stuff by unloading a shotgun into somebody's head is real dumb. And it makes a lot of other people unhappy, and it usually makes you unhappy in that they'll probably catch you and kill you. We're capable of ingesting all that. Things aren't too fast for anybody. The mind can take in a whole mess of stuff. We use a tenth of our brain power right now.
Do you think, on the whole, that young people are really more aware, more appreciative of life?
I see my parents appreciate a lot of stuff, and they laugh and do exactly the same things I do. They were building for themselves, essentially, trying to build the kind of thing that would work for their generation, and they did, more or less, and that's what worked for them. Now we are trying to build something that works for us. We live faster. We move differently. 40, 50 years ago, you could live in a small town. Chances are you'd only be attracted to one or two, maybe, people in the town. You could stay married for that length of time. Kids now meet thousands of people every year. You can't help but loving some of them. So the morality has changed. When people part now, there isn't any of this business of, well, I'll get you back, mother, you know, give me the furniture, or, you know, any of that kind of stuff. We usually live with each other for, I mean, it could go on forever. That's nice, too. If it does that, fine. Any way is good. But there isn't any bitterness about moving from one person to another. And the people that you've lived with before usually become your friends, you know, very good friends. So it's it changes according to need and according to desire. And the morality changes.
But among young boys and girls today, do you think they treat them each other any differently than a generation ago or before that?
It's possible that a male may confide more of what he's doing to a female as far as what he does, you know, if it's with his hands or his work. Because chances are the woman is possibly as educated as he is and able to discuss it. A woman a long time ago may not have been educated, so she didn't have anything to say on the subject. No point in talking to her. It's the same thing as trying to talk about how to sew the lining inside a dress to a male. It's no fun. They don't know anything about it. But I don't say they're second class, or I don't say I'm second class. It's just two different things that we do, and they don't know anything about it, so I don't discuss it with
different
them.
Different bags.
Yeah. I don't feel particularly second class or first class or any class. I just feel like this is me and you're you, and we'll talk about whatever we can that we have in common. If we don't, maybe I'll teach you something, or you'll teach me something.
Grace Slick on Something to Say in September 1970. Slick retired from the music business in 1989, saying that all rock and rollers over the age of 50 look stupid and should retire. She has, however, performed on several occasions, special occasions, since then. I'm Michael Enright, and you're listening to Rewind, the archive show here on CBC Radio 1. Our next interview is with Jim Morrison of The Doors. Jim Morrison became legendary for his dark and controversial lyrics and for his onstage performances. His death in Paris just 10 months after this interview ensures his place in history as a pop culture icon. Here's the host of Something to Say, Warren Davis.
The quality of rock and roll, like any other form of music, varies with the performers. The Beatles are, of course, the prototypes. And there are few groups that have approached their inventiveness and their effectiveness. In America, a quartet who call themselves The Doors have won a huge following. All five of their record albums have done more than $1 million worth of business each. Jim Morrison is the leader of The Doors. Like Grace Slick, he's a dropout from middle-class America. Since breaking with his family, neither Morrison nor his father, a high-ranking U.S. Navy officer, have spoken to one another. Those who know him say Jim Morrison is confused and confusing, at one moment sane and knowledgeable, and at another freaking out. Morrison has several times been arrested on stage for what the police term lewd and obscene conduct. He's also the author of a book of poetry published by Doubleday and selling well. His poetry and his songs mark him as a spokesman for a section of the young generation. Disdainful, furious, sensual, intentionally shocking.
Jim, what do young people worship today? What do they believe? What do they hang on to? What do they hope for?
I can't speak for young people, but probably a guess would be the same things they've always celebrated, just kind of a joy of existence, self-discovery, freedom, that kind of thing.
Politically and philosophically, the young people now seem to feel very definite ideas about the establishment,
mm-hmm.
old systems of governing people, and moral attitudes.
Yeah. When I was in high school and college, the kind of protest that's going on now is totally unheard of. At that time, to be a teenager, to be young, was really nothing. It was kind of a limbo state. And I think it's amazing, just in the last 5 years, what's happened is young people have come increasingly aware of the power and the influence that they have as a group. It's really amazing.
Does it surprise you that there is so much revolt on the campuses of this country against Washington and its policies?
It really surprises me because, as I said before, when I was growing up and when I was in school, it was that was totally unheard of. You know, students really had no power. But if you look back in history, it seems to bear out the fact that every revolution has started with students and spread to workers, and I'm not predicting that there's going to be a drastic turnover in this country, but all the indications are there.
There's a line in your book of poems which reads, "The cleavage of men into actor and spectators is the central fact of our time." Well, I think that's undeniable, but I wonder, hasn't it always been that way with society?
I suppose it has, but it's with mass media and all today, it becomes more immediately apparent. I think what I was concerned with in that book was the fact that most people feel completely void and helpless in controlling their own destinies or controlling the destiny of human life. And I think it's sad. More people should be involved rather than designating all these powers to a few individuals. I think the average person, whatever that is, should be a part of it somehow. And I think everyone feels that events are just going on without their knowledge or control. I think it's one of the tragedies of our time. I suppose it has always been that way, but now it's just become so obvious, you know. Decisions are made for you in which you have no part of at all. I just lament the fact that so many people are content with living quiet, well-mannered, orderly life when so many obvious injustices, I guess, are going on, and they just seem to ignore it somehow, or not care at all, just let it happen without ever becoming involved. I think that's sad.
Jim, relevant to your theory that people should get more involved in life and thus enjoy it more, you have written a line of poetry which reads, "The spectator is a dying animal." Now, isn't that a bit of a contradiction to what you've said previously?
No, it's concerned with that same split between the actor and the audience. To me, there's something incredibly sad about a bunch of human beings sitting down watching something take place. And just when you think about it, I love movies as much as anyone else, but the spectacle of millions and millions of people sitting in movie theaters and in front of television sets every night watching a second or third hand reproduction of reality going on when the real world is right there in their living room or right outside in the street or down the block somewhere. I think it's a tool to somnambulize or hypnotize people into a kind of waking sleep. But I think the major influence in the next decade or so is going to be the people, I don't know what you'd call them except maybe the connectors, the people who are able to assemble masses, huge masses of people into one spot, as we've witnessed in pop festivals in the last 2 or 3 years. The kind of people that can assemble huge crowds in one spot, I think, will be the major influences on mass culture in the next decade. I think the rock music enthusiasts have created probably some of the most exciting music and theatrical events on the planet. I think they're fantastic.
Well, part of generation gap is the difference in what people like in terms of music. Now, the rock and hard rock do seem to go hand in hand with the younger crowd, and some of us who are a little older are confused and puzzled by that, because we can't quite cotton on to this sound. Can you understand that?
You know, adolescence and early youth, the fires are burning fastest, right? And your energy level is probably at its highest, and so it demands a kind of raucous, screaming type music. And I'm 26 now, and I'm getting more interested in jazz, to tell you the truth. I can't even listen to the radio anymore. You know, I like old blues cats and early rock and roll and some other things, but frankly, I find most of it really boring.
This is something that distresses me a little bit. It seems that the young people like all the same kind of thing. Now, I want more out of the young people than just that.
Yeah, well, they're being programmed by their radios. They only play the major radio stations, rock stations, only play 30 songs over and over and over, 24 hours a day. And it's been proven that what you hear the most is what you like the most. So there's really no choice involved. Someone is programming it.
So we are the victims of media.
Uh-huh. What everyone should say is the medium is the message, and the message is me. I mean, that's the answer, is for everyone to... You're asking for an answer. The answer is for everyone to stand up and say, I'm me, and be fully aware of that fact and let everyone else know it.
Yeah.
That you are yourself, and express it.
Jim, we're talking about communication, watching the box, etc., being victimized by the media. Well, there's a sort of a voyeurism in the air today, and you have a line which says, more or less, we're all afflicted with the psychology of the voyeur. That, to me, seems to be tragic.
What it is somehow life gets restricted to what can be seen rather than what can be touched or experienced physically. I don't know whether it's a natural, civilized human fear of involvement, because, you know, touch can lead to a lot of touch. Physical involvement leads to all the, you know, the real basic existential moments in life. Sex, death, love, you know. They have really nothing to do with seeing, experiencing secondhand. You have to get in there and actually do it. And there just seems to be some kind of natural civilized inclination to avoid contact with the nitty-gritty of life.
Well, we can't talk about life today and not talk about sex. Now, this confuses me, because we have a so-called new morality, and I keep looking at it and trying to figure out what it is.
There is, though, you know. I can remember when I was in high school, and even college, which wasn't that many years ago, and sex was still in the Victorian age. It was... very hush-hush. You know, if you suspected a girl of you know, one of the ones that was doing it, you know, it was like kind of a, you know, locker room conversations and all that. And I think that this new group of kids that have come along have, you know, I mean, sex will always be a mystery and it will always have its hang-ups and strange things about it. But they're much more free. I mean, it's just, you know, accepted as a fact of life and not, you know, not something to be snickered about in private, you know, behind closed doors and all that. I think there definitely is a new style.
Do you wish you were 10 years younger?
Nah. No. I think generations now happen every year or maybe every month, you know, rather than it used to be, I don't know, 10 years or something like that. But I think there's a new, things are changing so fast, there's a new generation every year at least.
Jim, I don't think there's any topic that has sort of defined the young revolution more than the topic of war. I don't know anyone who's really in favor of war, but today we seem to have an entire young generation absolutely opposed to the very idea of it.
And probably because they're the ones that always fight the wars. They're the human fodder for the war machine. And there just seems to be no way around it. There's just no cause. I'm sure the whole basis of the war going on now is economic, and I think young people just got tired of being grist for the mill. But you know, it's a funny thing. From the comfortable position of your TV set in your living room, war is a very no matter how horrible, well, it's the horror, it makes it very glamorous, you know. It's a great drama, life and death right there, a struggle. And we're all infected from youth, you know, with little kids running around playing war and playing cowboys and Indians or whatever. You know, it's somehow it's just ingrained in you from the beginning that there's something heroic, you know, proving yourself in battle and all that kind of thing.
The very hero concept seems to have changed in these past few years, doesn't it?
No heroes have come out of this present conflict. It's very strange. There's no support for it, hardly even in the press, you know.
And the young people no longer worship warriors the way we used to.
Right. Somewhere in you, you have to entertain these utopian concepts that life could work without all that struggle, you know. Probably not, but I mean, something in us always entertains the fantasy that the world could run without war.
Jim Morrison of The Doors, Grace Slick of the Jefferson Airplane, and Charlie Allen of Pacific Gas and Electric, the rock stars with Something to Say to Tony Thomas.
From September 1970, the program Something to Say. Just 10 months later, Jim Morrison died in Paris of a drug overdose. And that's all for the Rewind podcast this week. If you'd like to hear more great material from the CBC Radio Archives, tune in to Rewind. It airs Thursday nights at midnight on CBC Radio 1, and the rest of the week Sunday through Friday at 2 p.m. and again at 1 a.m. and 5 a.m. on Sirius Radio 137. I'll be back next week with a new episode of Rewind. I'm Michael Enright. Thank you for listening.
For more on all of our CBC podcasts, head to cbc.ca/podcasting.